Well, it's an honor to talk to you, Linda Jackson. I just became incredibly aware the audience listening cannot see us, but we can see each other. And
yes.
I am the least fashionable I have ever been right now. I'm wearing a white singlet. It's very basic and very dull, so I feel a little bit underdressed.
No, but I love simple.
Okay. Yep. you're in Mudgee at the moment.
I am in Mudgee. I have a beautiful place in the bush that I bought in the mid-80s that's near Mudgee. And this, I've got a fabulous exhibition of photographs that were taken during the fire. Mm-hmm. Our place burnt during the fire, and it's at the new Mudgee Art Precinct. It's a fantastic gallery in Mudgee. So I'm the second exhibition, and it's been really amazing to work with this team. I started taking photographs when I was quite small, mm-hmm. and over the years, lots of photographs of Jenny out bush and with Peter and David and everyone with their, you know, with the frocks and things like that. So having an exhibition of the photographs that's based on the positive outlook that sort of seemed to happen with me being in lockdown out in this gorgeous place in the bush when it went from black to sort of psychedelic, luminous, fluorescent yellow and green with the regrowth.
Mm.
And it's just opened just last week, so it's fantastic.
Wow. Those names that you just casually dropped, of course, were the Jenny is Jenny Key, Peter Tully, yes. and David McDermott. You've been sort of a bit of a group of Australian artists and designers who if not queer themselves, have lived sort of queerly, queerly inflected, it's been described. What has been, I don't know, I can imagine that there must be some lovely solidarity in having a group of people from, I think, the 70s, possibly before, that you've sort of been
consistent
with. I met
Peter Tully in 1968.
Wow.
Carlton, and I was wandering, I was studying photography, and I was walking down the street of actually in Carlton, and this lovely lady stopped me, well, girl, we were teenage, or not quite teenagers, but, and said, oh, look, I'm Jenny, why don't you come and meet my friends? They're just around the corner. They'll love you. You look fabulous. And it was Peter Tully, Clarence Chai, Paul Kraft, and Murray Kelly in their cute little house in Cardigan Street in Carlton. And it was like I walked in the door and we were immediately fabulous friends because they were making their costumes to go to an arts ball at that time. And it was like, well, that was the start of a really amazing, incredible, fabulously colourful, queer, all over the top, everything friendship.
That just actually made me feel really emotional. Just the idea of in 1968 meeting this group of people that you've had parallels with and friendships with and relationships with up until today.
Up How until beautiful. Today, yes, exactly. And that's when I met Fran Moore and with Peter Tully. We actually, by beginning of 1970, we were going to travel the world together. So the three of us were just really dear, close friends. And we first went to live in New Guinea for quite a while, you know, for quite a few months, and then travelled all through the East, through to Paris, bit of London. Peter went off to Africa and, you know, was quite inspired by that, and then back to Thailand and then back down to Sydney to Melbourne. So, yeah, we... And it was learning about other cultures that was a really big thing for both Peter and I at the time, and being inspired by what people wore and, you know, the beautiful, the jewellery and the costume and the pieces and the headdresses and things like that. So it was those early days of sharing those things, yeah.
How important is that idea of sharing? Because I think so often artists can think of themselves as soloists, or people can think of the artist as being the only person involved in the process. But, I mean, I know there's so much, not just creative, like there's emotional support, there's support from friends and family. But I feel like having those other artists that you came up with, there must be really special and unique to have that sort of collective.
It was very unique and inspiring. I think we all inspired each other.
Yeah.
And the friendship was like, that was really important, actually, and keeping those friendships through all the difficulties, whatever the fabulous things that would happen or what emotional difficult the trials of life and different things like that that happened. Mm. We were always there for each other, and we loved what each other did, mm. which is also a really big deal. And the inspiring and the collective of working together. With Peter, it was, you know, when Jenny and I were doing the Flamingo Park shows, Peter made the beautiful jewellery. And, you know, when I met David, he started painting on the beautiful frocks. I'd cut out the shapes and he would paint them. And that started from like 1974. So, and it didn't stop. Our friendships remained through all our lives, you know, wow. which was amazing.
Just beautiful. I do want to come to the fashion, but you mentioned that you began studying photography.
I studied fashion design at Emily McPherson College of Domestic Economy. It's part of RMIT now, mm-hmm. when I was age 15, 16. Mm-hmm. And I thought I wanted to do fashion illustration, actually, because that's what I loved. I loved drawing and painting. And when I went to Paran Tech to study the art, within a few days I ended up actually moving into the photographic department, and maybe the people that I'd met at Paran Tech, maybe I thought the photography people were much more interesting, but I'd still already had loved taking photographs. My grandpa had a great big camera. Mum took photographs of me, lots of photographs, and I borrowed her brownie box camera and would take photographs of my doll dressed up, or, you know, of which I have the photographs because Mum kept them, oh, wow. and taking photographs of Christine Wheeler, who lived next door, and I'd dress her up in some of Mum's, you know, Mum and Dad met ballroom dancing. So, you know, wow. The photography thing started sort of early.
Yeah.
And going to Paran Tech, Paul Cox was my teacher, who was a really well-known filmmaker, and Carol Jerrams became a really close friend, who was an amazing photographer. And I just kept on taking photographs. And so with Peter and Fran, when we were travelling, I took photographs. You took rolls of film with you, and mm-hmm. we'd get them processed, and then I would send them back home to Mum. So all those early days, those things were kept. And then when I met Jenny in the early days, 1973, she became my muse of my, you know, being able to, she'd become the Scribbly Gum Tree or the Waratah. And so we'd spend a lot of time. That was our meditative times together of being in the bush and the photography. So I think the photography in those days was important for all of us, recording, mm. you know, the documentation. Plus we loved sending, you know, when Peter and David travelled, sending postcards then, sometimes with, you know, there could have been our photograph that we wrote on the back of and things like that. So, yeah, the photographs in those early days were really important.
In this series, I've also spoken to William Young, who talked a lot about, you know, his photography in the 70s and 80s. And I asked him if he was aware of the importance and the significance of those photos at the time he was taking them. And he said that he was more just there sort of documenting, and it's only become in recent years where capturing those images of even like the party scene, which I would imagine at the time would feel quite flippant and frivolous, you know, it's gay people having parties. But now we look back at this retrospective of a time capsule of, in particular, gay Sydney. Those photos Absolutely. That you were taking at the time, were you... the fact that you're sending them back to Mum, you must have known that of their importance.
Oh, they were important, I guess. And because of growing up with Mum's, the books that you had the photographs in mm. that we loved looking at, and because we were travelling for all those years, you couldn't take we couldn't take everything with us. So sending things back, Mum kept all my aerogram letters, so there's all these descriptions of our travels. I'm so grateful, actually, too, because it was... the dates and where we were and different things like that. It's so fantastic to read about them.
Yeah.
And I think I loved the photographs, and that's probably why they were important to me. And, you know, William's photographs for us in those days, we all looked fantastic and we were all having a really wonderful time. And he was so amazing with taking his photographs. He just had a special feeling about him, and we'd be all, it was fun, and we'd be, you know, with Jenny and I, we'd always, you know, we were all dressed up and we were happy, and we were, he just got some great photographs just because of the particular person that he is.
Yes.
In a way, they're posed, but not sort of posed. There was something casual but fantastic about them. Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting. I was never, I was always aware of William. I moved to Sydney and came out in the year 2000. But I had never actually met him before, but I knew of his photographs. But I am aware of that idea of different photographers taking photographs. And there were some who just had a knack for making you feel comfortable, making the moment feel comfortable, capturing this photo. And then there were some that always felt like they were putting a square peg into a round hole. And
Taking too many, you see. Yeah. And then you can sort of veer off. But with William, he'd take one or two photographs and he captured something.
Mm.
Whereas, you know, I've had my photograph taken quite a bit over the years, and sometimes in more recent times it's just going click, 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 and you know, you lose that essence of a beautiful photograph of the person after a few minutes, or you know. But William, there was something that, and he seemed, just the way that he had his camera, it wasn't always like right in front of you. It was there, but it was him that you were looking at. So he was our special, you know, he was a special friend.
Yeah. So tell me, the photography, you said you started studying fashion and then sort of parlayed into photography. When did it veer back into fashion? Because, of course, you're known, you know, as this prolific Australian fashion designer.
I always made my own clothes from age 12. Then I made them for my cousins and then for friends, and that just kept on. And you know, with travel, I'd still make the odd thing for the odd friend. Even somebody would lend me a sewing machine in Paris or in London, and I could always whip up something for someone.
Wow.
And it was, you know, when I met Jenny that we connected in such a fantastic way, and I started just, you know, having the gorgeous vintage fabrics from Jobs Warehouse in Melbourne, and just started, you know, working with her. We met just as she was opening the shop, Flamingo Park, in the Strand Arcade. So,
and that opened in 1973?
Yes, the end of 73. And our first fashion show was in the Hingara restaurant in 1974. And the next one that David started hand-painting for was at the Bondi Pavilion at Bondi Beach in 1975.
Are there any of those, I'm sure they all stand out, but is there one that stands out? And tell me, what do you remember from that time? Like, can you describe?
Oh, there's too many things to remember.
What about Flamingo Park Frock Salon? Can you describe what it looked like? How big was it?
It was actually quite tiny in the Strand Arcade, and it was blue, metallic, incredible colour that Jenny's husband had done the decor, and it was had blue carpet. It was very colourful and quite different to any other sort of little boutique at the time, and it was called Flamingo Park Frock Salon. So it had this other vintage, ethereal quality about it. And after the 75, when I started making more evening wear, Jenny then was able to get the shop next door and had the doorway opened, and that was painted vibrant red with pink taffeta curtains, and that's where more of the dress-up sort of things were. And there was Peter's jewellery in there, you know, the beautiful plastic, incredible pieces that he was making. And, you know, it just grew from there of being creative and wanting to have our own fabrics printed. It was wonderful for me to be able to collaborate with David and with some other artists too. Hant and Bruce Gould was one in particular, and Deborah Laser. We could do whatever we wanted. So that's what was so exciting at that time. That's why we were free. There were no labels. It was quite different to the way that, you know, everything's filed into certain names and letters and things now. But in those days, we all, a variety of oddball folks, and we all collaborated and egged each other on and respected what each of us were doing, and through friendship as well.
Would you say the only label really was artist back then?
Probably artist, having fun, being creative, and dressing up each other and sharing was a big thing, yeah. Mm. And I know, you know, with Peter and David starting with Mardi Gras in those early days, I mean, that was awesome what they were able to. They were already having exhibitions, being creative together and separately, and David would hand paint the posters for some of Peter's exhibitions and things, because I've just been rereading, rereading just about some of the early things that were happening. And we were all having wonderful exhibitions around town, which then would inspire other younger people as well. But when the Mardi Gras started, that was amazing.
Right. That was it. I mean, obviously,
late 70s.
Yeah, for someone like me looking back, I know the history, but I wasn't there. But for you in your memory, that was a significant moment.
Because it meant everything that Peter and David were doing was bigger than anything had ever been seen before, because they were so inspired by other festivals in other countries. Mm-hmm. And with Jenny and I, with our exhibition at the Powerhouse Museum that was on at the end of 2019 through 2020, they sponsored a Mardi Gras float for us called Step Into Paradise. It was based on our exhibition, and that was awesome. Wow. And to be involved in that, and I had to make rainbow turbans, and we wore rainbow colours on our float, and it just, to be there with everyone just for us brought back so many memories of all our dear friends who were no longer with us, that were all part of the instigation of actually having a Mardi Gras festival.
Was that your first time in the parade?
Yes.
It's a
to be on a float properly, yes.
It's a special thing being in the parade, isn't it? I always say to people, the best way to see Mardi Gras is to be in it.
Right. And how many times have you been in it?
Oh,
a few times.
Quite a few. In the recent years, I've been hosting it on the TV, so I'm not marching. There's something magical. And I know back in the beginning, it didn't start where it did now, but these days in that marshalling area down the bottom of Oxford Street.
Where you're starting and getting ready.
Everyone's gathered, and there's such an energy.
Was fantastic. Yeah. Behind the scenes, backstage, so to speak, was just wonderful.
And then the parade
starts. And seeing
starts.
Everybody getting ready and all the amazing costumes and going, oh, wow, that's, everyone's looking amazing.
Yeah. And then it's almost like that moment as well of you feel like a superstar as you go up Oxford Street.
Yes.
And there's just hundreds of thousands of people cheering.
Well, I hadn't known anything quite like it, and I thought, oh, wow, like, but then you suddenly, you're moving, you're dancing, and you're just waving, and it makes you smile so much to see everybody. It was just so beautiful.
Wow.
Really beautiful.
Oh. And to get to share it with, your family, I guess, your chosen family of friends, that must be a beautiful moment as well.
Yeah, and the memories of, remembering all our dear friends who aren't around now, but, still live on in beautiful ways.
Yeah. So back at Flamingo Park Frock Salon, you started selling your fashion there. And what were some of the milestones or key moments that took things to the next level?
I think that the fact that we did a show every year, once a year, was the beginning of every year. Jenny and I'd have all these ideas, and then it would begin to involve Peter and David and, with the models who were friends and things like that over the years. Every year was something that was important, because we worked in the fact that we could have different themes that were inspired by different parts of the country or by different artists that inspired us. And the collaboration of, like, for example, working with David, working out what were we going to do together, and I'd cut out the shapes and he'd take them home and hand paint them. And, so working together like that was, we could do anything. Mm. He painted incredible delicate gum leaves on dresses. Then they started to become more and more abstract. So, documenting them over the years, and because we always recorded and our shows were photographed, William was there, actually, of course, with every show. So, having all those photographs means that we've got it all documented. So it's easy for us to look back and tell those stories of all the different artists that we were working with.
And when did the Australian flora and fauna elements start appearing in the work?
Day one.
What was it about? Because that was very unique at the time, right? There was no one else who was doing that. You sort of saw this wonder and included it.
No, not how we were looking at it. Well, just to have travelled for me in all those countries. Jenny lived in London all that time. Arriving back, being inspired by this incredible country, the blue sky, the beautiful flowers. The first dress that came out in the first show in Chinatown was the Opera House dress because it had opened the year before. It was simple blue with white sails that made the sleeve and the collar and around, you know, applique. It was like, well, it was obvious, of course. Why not have the Opera House dress as the first dress?
I was just looking at a photograph of you and Jenny in those two blue dresses. I think one of them was the Opera House dress and I think it was called Bondi Blue was the name of the colour. And I just looked at them and there was such simplicity and such beauty. I put a big smile on my face looking at the two of you and those two dresses together and trying to, you know, imagine that time. And I've lived overseas for the last sort of, I don't know, I guess 12 years. And sometimes we Australians have a cultural cringe and it seems that you didn't or that you embraced the Australianness of it all and celebrated it.
Yeah, we embraced the Australianness. We loved it. The Opera House was extraordinary. Our birds are incredible and colourful and wild, and the animals are, and the flowers are extraordinary. It's like I'm not in London or in England or Europe. Why do I need to do a rose? Like a waratah, so much better. That we just looked to what was around us and wanted to know more, you know, wanted to know more about Indigenous life and the land and the beauty and things like that. So it just was. And we were so far away from everyone else that it didn't really matter. They didn't know what we were doing and we were having such a great time. I guess learning about things like that when you're growing up as well is if you love painting and drawing that you're looking out at something. And or if you're taking photographs of the landscape, you're actually looking at it. So
it feels like you're ahead of the time in that essence. And another way that you're ahead of the time was that you were such an early adopter of sustainability within fashion and also celebrating and elevating Indigenous design and producing in Australia. It sounds like that feeds in from that idea that we were just talking about, but even the idea of sustainability.
Oh, that was important for me at the time because knowing, having travelled and been to different factories and, you know, where people hand make things and then you go to a factory where you know that the dye is toxic because they're bleaching the fabric. And I just learned about those things really early. I'd like to know or if I could visit the places if I was getting fabric from India. I went to India and I went to the places that I was getting the saris and where I was getting something printed. I think I always like to know the source, and that's what happened when I fell in love with opals. Of course, I had to go to Lightning Ridge and Cupidpedia in Queensland to go to where the opals come from and to meet the people who are mining and working with them. So, you know, it's just that thing of getting to know more about the people that you're collaborating with.
Wow. I think that's something for young Australian artists in all of that, because we do live in such a connected world with the internet these days, and it's very easy, I think, for Australians to discredit the beauty and the wonder of our country and sort of place higher value and higher importance in things from overseas, whether it be fashion or celebrities or art or culture. But I think it's so, just in what you're saying there, it's so important to remember and to really dig into the beauty and wonder that we have here, because it is so unique.
Yes, and, you know, we were here and we travelled over there, but I didn't want to go and live back there.
Yeah.
This, I was happy to be here, and because we were so far away from the rest of the world, in those days it seemed much further, you know, quite different with having to make phone calls and you'd have to fly everywhere or get a boat. Mm. It was amazing to be here and to be isolated but in an incredible, beautiful place and be inspired by it. We were a tiny business, really, for both of us, with our little shop, and then when I had my studio where I made everything, and people loved it. That's what kept it going, is because that the relationship that you'd have between the people that you were making clothes for or who were coming into the shop or coming into the studio.
I love that. I want to talk about fashion as a signifier of sexuality and I guess identity at large. I had a pivotal moment in my sort of, I guess, like gender and sexuality, which was not all that long ago, where I went shopping with a group of friends, two friends.
Yeah.
And I never trusted my own style advice because I would always end up coming home with things that I liked but never went together, or they're a bit too loud, you could only wear once. And I went shopping with some friends, and through their sort of guidance.
Where were you shopping?
We were shopping in Los Angeles.
Right.
And going around to all of these shops, and they were sort of listening and seeing what I liked, and then allowing me, celebrating me, giving me the confidence to buy them. And we put together this outfit that we called Summer Sorbet. And it was simply just a lot of different pastels in this one outfit. But it was, prior to that, an outfit I probably wouldn't have bought if I was by myself, because I would have, I don't know, second-guessed myself, but having them to support me there. And it, weirdly, that outfit, this we've called Summer Sorbet, was a pivotal moment in me really embracing my gender expression. And ever since that day, I've basically been dressed in, you know, pastels ever since.
Right.
Fashion as a signifier of sexuality and identity. I want to talk about how clothing can be used to create visible queer identity.
Well, my mum used to make all my clothes, mm-hmm. and mum and dad met ballroom dancing. So I had ball gowns to dress up in. Quite simple ball gowns, actually, from, you know, I was born in 1950. And then I did ballet and calisthenics and gymnastics and things. So there was always that bit of dressing up. And mum made my clothes. And then when I was becoming a teenager at about 12, I wanted them made a certain way. So she said, well, I think it's time that you learn to sew and you can make your own clothes, because she realised she wasn't getting it right. And she encouraged me. So I never used to go shopping really to buy clothes, because I loved making my own, being inspired by what I saw, I guess, in Vogue magazines or whatever, or different things like that. And that's how I worked out how to dress myself. So that's why I always made my own clothes. And I think, I guess I didn't really care what other people thought about what I wore, even in those early days. And that makes a huge big difference, probably. And I wore glasses, so if I took my glasses off, I couldn't really see if you were liking what I wore or not, probably. But it's interesting to go through this discussion, because it's just having the confidence to be who you are. And was it easier then, when the world was a bit more conservative in a way, or maybe they didn't take as much notice of us? Or it's a really interesting topic, because with Peter and David, they really, well, Peter was an incredible person who could create these unbelievable costumes to dress up in. For some of us, we had the confidence to be going way out there, and all of us loving bright colours meant that we became, I guess, a bit of a tribe of people who loved that. Mm. But sometimes there were earthy colours as well. So you can really wear what you want. I don't really care about fashion as fashion, that you are supposed to wear something. I don't really agree with that.
Yeah.
I think it's just have the confidence to have fun and to, you know, wear what you like, really. But that's not always an easy thing to do.
No, I guess that also plays into this idea of gender in fashion. I've always found it so fascinating. Like, nobody was born, women weren't born wearing dresses, men weren't born wearing trousers. You know, cave people weren't wearing, well, we don't really know what they were wearing, but I'm sure that these ideas of fashion were probably more utilitarian back then. It was more about
warmth. Would have been what suited the climate.
Yeah,
they would have come from what you had around you to make your clothes out of, and they would have all developed in that way. Like in that, it's like in Australia, you're freezing cold in Melbourne, so you wear different clothes. Then you're in Sydney, and it's a lot more. You know, this is just from my travels growing up as well, actually, and learning about things. I'd be in Alice Springs. That's where I developed bush couture from, because, you know, I have made clothes that you could get dirty with red dirt and they still look fabulous. So, or you'd be in Darwin and you could only wear tropical things, and then you'd be in Cairns, and that's another whole, this whole country is full of different climates that you have to adapt to as well.
One of the pieces that is in the queer exhibition at the National Gallery is, it says Black and White Calligraphy, 1978. And this piece was designed for a female body, but it references men's tailoring traditions, which I guess, where are we, 1978?
That was black taffeta, and David hand-painted with white paint I think he wrote our names on it also. And then it was something, I didn't always do this, but it was making a special taffeta jacket that I then cut into his piece of artwork that he'd painted. But it was quite a simple shape, so it wasn't changing it too much. And that was the black taffeta jacket worn with black taffeta pants, yeah.
You've had such a positive influence on fashion in Australia and around the world with your designs and the boldness and the colours and just the wonder of it all. Where are you hoping Australian fashion heads in the future with regards to those sort of topics of identity and gender and such?
Well, what I'm really excited about is having been out to Indigenous communities from about 1980, starting going out to Alice Springs and Utopia and Coringa Arts and a few others, is to see, and from seeing their textiles that they were hand-painting and batik in those early days, to see all the young Indigenous designers now coming out in the last 5 years or so, and the last couple of years really a lot more, and with some of the elders in a lot of the communities as well, doing amazing weavings, incredible hand-painted fabrics, working with printers who can print more commercial versions in collaboration with the community so that, you know, things can be done. And just to see the First Nations really coming out there with all genders and being able to dress the way they want to dress, I'm really excited to see what they contribute to the world. Because that's how you know, it works with your friends and how you love what your friend is doing and you want to wear that. It sort of starts off in those small ways, and it only works if it works and your friends love it. Then it can reach more people as well, and then it can spread to the world. So it's, and with different genders, it'll be amazing to see what the young designers do now with more freedom in that regard.
Well, I guess you know, for me, fashion is something that I love to wear, and I think that one of the biggest joys is sharing it with friends. Like, you know, you're getting dressed up to go to a party, even if it's a Mardi Gras. My life is sort of compartmentalized, or I remember it by what I wore to Mardi Gras that year. So if I need to trace a memory, I'm like, okay.
Oh,
so,
and what's going to happen this year? This will be a special one.
I know. I've been talking to my friend Marco, who has been making my Mardi Gras frocks for the last few years, and because I'm hosting it on the telly, so we're sort of talking. We always talk about different ways to use rainbow, because sometimes
there's,
you know,
endless ways of using a rainbow.
There are endless ways, and I just love it because sometimes a rainbow, in a commercial sense, can become a little bit predictable. You know, people just sort of slap a rainbow on, and I'm like, oh, it's such a wonderful thing. And finding new ways to wear rainbow is my favorite Mardi Gras pastime. Well, it's been absolutely a delight chatting to you today. I really appreciate you taking time.
Thank you.
And I look
It's special friends to think about. And amazing to be included in this exhibition with the work of David's, really. And to have a chat about the stories is wonderful.
Well, I think in this exhibition we have got Clarence, Jenny, David, and Peter all being represented in queer. So these people that, you know, this conversation has been about, not only have you been side by side, you know, since the late 60s, but you'll be side by side in the queer exhibition at the National Gallery.
Yes.
Thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
I love that chat with Linda. Now I want to go and dive into that wonderful queer collective of artists, Peter Tully, David McDermott, Jenny Key, and find out more about that wonderful time in Australian art history. I hope you also enjoyed my chat with Angela Hessen. Next episode, I'm going to be talking to Frida Taranzo-Jaeger, who uses painting to explore the ideas of hybridity, sexuality, and autonomy. I'm also going to be chatting to curator Pip Wallace. I'm going to be talking queer strategies. So, this is a podcast you've been listening to, but there is so much art you can look at here at the National Gallery of Victoria in Melbourne. The exhibition titled Queer is free and it's on display from the 10th of March through to the 21st of August 2022. I'm Courtney Act. Thank you so much for listening.